Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Welcome, and thank you for joining us. I just finished talking with Michael Roos about his new book, The Gaia Hypothesis, Science on a Pagan Planet. And this is hot off the presses with the University of Chicago Press and just came out very recently in 2013. The book itself is extraordinarily carefully laid out, very clearly argued, and very clearly structured. And it takes the form of an articulation of the emergence, the various kinds of historical and philosophical backgrounds, and the responses to an idea that's come to be known in broad terms as the Gaia hypothesis. Put very simply, this is an idea that in its most basic form takes the Earth to be a kind of living organism. And of course, the different ways of fleshing out that form, that argument, the different ways of articulating and changing that argument make up some of the argument of the book. And it's a really fascinating story. The book itself is written in an extraordinarily vibrant, sparkling, very fun style. And it was not only super, super fun and interesting to talk with Michael about it, but it was also really, really fun to get through the book. This is a book that's a pleasure to read. It's very clear to read, and it's going to be not only very widely readable, but also very widely assignable in classes and things that are that deal with topics that are relevant to the history of ecology, the history of public science, the history of biology, and many other related topics. Sprinkled throughout the book are vignettes and accounts of some really fascinating characters. And so there are individuals in this story that really come to life as part of the narrative in a wonderful way. So it was great fun to read, great fun to talk with Michael about the book, and I hope you enjoy the conversation and the book as much as I did. We're here today to talk with Michael Roos about his new book, The Gaia Hypothesis, Science on a Pagan Planet. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, Michael, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today about this brand new book.
Well, my pleasure. Actually, I'm down in Florida, and believe it or not, Florida is the wettest part of the U.S., far more than Seattle, and we've got absolutely pouring rain today. Oh, really? So what better than to talk about myself and what I've been doing?
Okay, great. So, Michael, could you start us off, as is traditional for our channel, to say a little bit about your background? How did you come to the field of history and philosophy of science in general, and a focus on the biological sciences in particular?
Well, as you can tell from my accent, I was born in England, and I grew up there. And then in 1962, actually September the 17th, 1962, I stepped off the boat, the Empress of England, in Quebec City in pouring rain, and I became a landed immigrant. And I stayed in Canada until 2000. I taught at the University of Guelph for 35 years. And then I moved south to Florida, Florida State, in order to avoid compulsory retirement. And I'm 73 years old and still going strong. So I'm a philosopher by training, and I did an undergraduate degree in philosophy, and then I did a PhD. I did what Canadians call thesis, and what Americans I've discovered called a dissertation.
Right.
And I wanted to do science, and so I wrote on evolutionary biology, which wasn't much discussed in those days. And what happened then was I wrote on the topic and around the topic, published my first book on this. But we're talking back 1970. And of course, the big book of the day then was Thomas Kuhn's Structural Scientific Revolutions. And Kuhn said, if you want to do good philosophy of science, you've got to know about the history of science. So for my first sabbatical from Guelph, I went to Cambridge in England and tooled up as a historian. And I've been writing on Darwin ever since. I wrote a little book on the Darwinian Revolution. And then I've been writing a lot right down to this year when I brought out a big encyclopedia, the Cambridge Encyclopedia of Darwin and Evolutionary Thought. So I've been writing on evolution and biology for a long, long time. I haven't written a great deal on geology or the earth sciences as such, but it's very hard, of course, to write on evolutionary biology without talking about paleontology. When I say hard, I don't want not to do it. And so about 3-4 years ago, I was asked by the Chronicle of Higher Education to review some books on the Gaia hypothesis, which I did. And then an editor I know at the University of Chicago Press asked me if I thought there was a book there. And my experience is that if an editor's interested in these things, then so am I. And as they say, you know, one thing led to another. And now here's the baby coming out in September.
That's great. Thank you. Now, you mentioned early on in the book that the aim of the book, or one aim of the book, is to show the ways that today's thinking about empirical questions, as you put it, is deeply influenced by the past. And this seems to really echo your initial comments about the importance of history and history to the training of a philosopher of science. It's really striking in the book and really, I think, quite wonderful from the perspective of someone in the field of history of science to see work that's so deeply committed to bringing together what, you know, some tend to find are two different disciplines, history of science and philosophy of science. And the book does this really beautifully. So can you start us off maybe by talking just a little bit about your approach to integrating the past into your story? How did you decide that this was a question that you wanted to approach with this particular way of integrating your philosophical background and skills with this particular way of doing history?
Well, as they say, that's a good question, Carla. I'm glad you asked that question. When I respond that way, it means I've got a good answer, or, oh, bloody hell, give myself a minute just to think of, you know, a response, but you're happy for the time being. Actually, I think I could probably give you a pretty good idea of what was going on here. You see, I mean, like everybody, I knew about the Gaia hypothesis. I knew that the whole idea of Gaia was of the Earth as an organism. But to be perfectly candid, I knew also that this was very much a flower children sort of idea. I mean, look, I'm old enough to remember the 60s and 70s. So I remember when Gaia came up and people were embracing it. And as I like to say, uncomfortable sandals and vegan diets. And so I knew all about this, but I quite frankly, it wasn't my sort of thing. So I certainly didn't know any details about it. So when I was asked to review these books, I mean, I did actually read them rather than just review them. And then, of course, when I was asked to do a, you know, the topic of actually doing a book on the subject came up, I got serious, as it were, and started in on it. And so I spent, let's say, 6 months or so reading the literature, reading stuff by the main players, Jim Lovelock and Lynn Margulis and some of the others. And then I got into the journal articles, and then I got into, you know, reading, what is it, Mother Jones and the Whole Earth Catalogue and this sort of thing. And basically, for the first 6 months, I kind of, immersed myself in it. Now, I don't like to read without writing, because I always find that writing is a good way to start focusing my points. So, the other thing I like to do is write first drafts and then second drafts and go all the way through, rather than try to get chapter one absolutely right, because I always find that by the time I get to chapter 10, I don't want chapter one anyway. So I that's what I did. And I worked through a hell of a lot of tedious stuff, you know, symposia from the 1980s where Jim Lovelock said, I believe this, and others said, no, you don't, or we don't. And Jim Lovelock said, yes, I do. Oh, my God, I worked through a hell of a lot of that stuff. And it became clear. And I mean, I to be a bit of a show off, I'm a fairly sophisticated writer. And I know that if you're going to write a book which is going to be interesting, you can't just, as it were, right from the beginning to the end and just simply say, well, Canada was founded in, 1867, and Sir John A. Macdonald was the first prime minister, and then we had this, and then we had that, and then we had the First World War, and so on. I mean, basically, I mean, if you were going to write a book, say, about Canada, you'd want to have a certain theme, say, about growing up or insecurities with respect to the states or whatever. I mean, I'm not saying one or the other, but the point is, history has to be a story, has to have a, I mean, it's like Dickens. Make them laugh, make them cry, make them wait. If it ain't a good story, then why are you bothering? So it became clear to me that just writing a book, as it were, saying, well, Gaia came up in the 1960s, which it did, when a man called Jim Lovelock, who was a British scientist, had this vision of the Earth as an organism. And then in 1970, he sort of, joined forces with this woman, Lynn Margulis, who was an American biologist, and they wrote some papers, and then Jim wrote a book, and then people criticized it. It became clear that this wasn't, this was a chronology, but this wasn't a book. And so I was basically looking for a hook on which I could hang things. And of course, the other thing is, you want to write your own book. You don't want to write a book that other people have written. I mean, one of the books I'd reviewed for the Chronicle in the first place was by a couple of science writers who said, oh, well, this has all been leading up to the Green Revolution, to global warming, and Gaia's is as it were, a lead up, and we need Gaia to understand this. Well, frankly, that just struck me as just, let me put it this way, not well taken. In other words, BS. That wasn't going to be my thing. But then, as it were, it hit me that what I was looking at was something really quite incredible and very revealing. Namely, Gaia was getting these completely different responses. The scientific community, almost to a person, absolutely loathed and hated it. Now, Richard Dawkins is good at loathe and hating everything, starting with me, and going on down or up. You can't just take the fact that Richard Dawkins doesn't like it as a sort of, a significant indicator that this is an important point. But the thing was, I was finding that real scientists like John Maynard Smith and Ford Doolittle, who's the very good biologist over at Dalhousie, I mean, they were, they didn't just dislike Gaia. I mean, it's one thing to say, well, I'm really not very fond of, fiddleheads or something, to talk something Canadian, but shall we say, but they, it was like people in Vancouver or people in Calgary feel about Toronto. They really, really hated it. They, it was visceral. I mean, they really, it wasn't just they didn't love, they really loathed it. It's okay, Carla. Nobody hates Vancouver. We all love British Columbia. Anyway, so that was the one side. And then, of course, on the other hand, I had all these people who were absolutely going nuts about Gaia. There was, there were Gaia festivals, there were Gaia church services, there's Gaia herbs, there's the Gaia Atlas, there's the Gaia spa, for rubbed up. There's even a Gaia network for people, for sensitive people or something like that. And I was thinking to myself, this is remarkable. Why is it that the scientific community absolutely loathed this idea? I mean, as I say, didn't just dislike it, but absolutely, really hated it. And the The general public loved it. Now, one other factor, which was, as it were, and I'll shut up and you can ask another question. One other factor was that Gaia was being promoted by these two people, Jim Lovelock, James Lovelock, and Lynn Margulis. Now, there's in the sociology of science, there's something which is known as the Matthew principle. To him that hath shall be given, and from him that hath not shall be taken away. In other words, what this basically says, if an important scientist has an idea, you take it seriously. And if a grad student, let us say, not from University of British Columbia, let's say a grad student from Simon Fraser has an idea, you laugh and say, well, you know, move on if you don't mind. But the point, God, I'm going to be very popular Simon Fraser, aren't I? But anyhow, the thing is, Lovelock had just got into the Royal Society. I mean, not the Royal Society of Canada. I mean, that any prole can get into that. I'm talking about the real one in England. Lynn Margulis was on her way, and she used to be married to Carl Sagan. Right. He never got into the National Academy of Science, but she did. She did. So he got these absolutely top-level scientists, and yet everybody is, you know, peeing all over them. So here was, you know, I suddenly said, you know, I've got a real hook here. And the nice thing is, I said, this is important for me because I've got a suspicion, and I think it panned out, that this is going to tell me something about science and the public. It's not going to be all about Gaia. It's not, I mean, it's going to be, as it were, a mirror or a lens or whatever the metaphor you want to use to get into the nature of science and science in the general public and those sorts of things. So that, you know, you can tell I'm excited because that's exactly what happened. So as I say at the beginning of my book, this is a book on Gaia, but it's not really about Gaia. I want to show, you know, more about it. Well, as you heard, I'm a philosopher. I'm a historian. So I'm not a scientist. I'm not a journalist. I'm not a sociologist. I mean, you know, I'm not any of these things. But I am a historian and philosopher. And so that's what I'm going to bring to bear to it. And that's what I did.
Thank you.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
No.
You're listening to a guy who's very excited.
No. This is great. No, I love this. And the book, I think also, just to mention for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read it, that kind of ebullience and real joy for the topic really does come through in the narrative and in the writing style, but also in the way that you've structured the story. And so it's really a pleasure to bring that to life orally and to hear you talk about it as well. This sense really comes through in the text also.
Well, you know, I'm glad about that because a couple of people say that, you know, and I'll tell you something. If you want boring, I mean, if you want double plus boring, try analytic philosophy in the average philosophy department in North America today. My God, it's dull. And the one thing I really take pride in is being able to tell a good story. And I really feel that I've done it this time. And, you know, it's not a question, is it true? Is it fun to read?
That's right. And I think also, so there are many, many really interesting things about not just your approach in the book, but about the story itself. And one of the really interesting things as we kind of work our way into the introduction in the beginning of the book is the kind of sources that you marshaled to tell this story. And you talked a little bit about that, sort of going through documentary archives, through oral histories. In addition to that, the research for the book, just to kind of lay this out briefly for listeners, and then I'll open it and let you go to town on it. But the research for the book includes also interviews with some of its main figures, including Lynn Margulis, James Lovelock, two of Lovelock's students, Andrew Watson and Timothy Lenton, and also a figure who I am sure we are going to talk about later, Oberon Zell Ravenheart, who stands out. I mean, he absolutely stands out in the story. So because this seems to be, it seems to be such an important part of the process that went into the storytelling for you, and it's really notable and it's really interesting to read about, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your experience doing these interviews in whatever way you wanted to. You know, you want to approach this. So do any moments stand out as particularly notable for you? Did those interviews at all transform the kind of narrative you decided to tell in the book?
Right. Well, yes. Well, that's, again, another terrific question. You see, if you're doing, say, a standard history of science book, and I've done them, then, you know, if you want to go beyond the printed material, you go to the unpublished stuff. And in the old days, you went to the archives. Of course, these days, so much of it is up on the net. You don't need to do that kind of traveling anymore. But when I, you know, did my work on Darwin, I spent a lot of time at the University Library in Cambridge going through Darwin's papers. Then I go up to London to the Royal Society to look at stuff. I went to the what is now the British Library to look at some of Alfred Russel Wallace's letters and that sort of thing. The stuff's all there. Now, I wanted to do some of that in this book. But at the same time, I realized I was dealing with living figures. And one of the things which I wanted to step carefully around was I didn't want to get too close emotionally, as it were, to the, my main figures. I wanted to be as empathetic as it was possible to be. I really wanted to get under their skins. But I, at a certain level, I didn't want to become their friend. And I'll tell you, one of the books I actually reviewed, I felt that that was a problem they ran into, that they'd become so close to Lovelock and his wife that I felt that they'd lost a level of objectivity. And so the point is, I had to be in a position to say what I wanted to say about these people rather than what they wanted me to say about these people. So I wanted to interview these people. I wanted to look at stuff that they'd written and a lot of stuff like that, and I did. But at the same time, I didn't want to spend an awful lot of time going through their private papers, staying with them and that sort of thing, because then I felt that obviously my relationship with them would change. And if there were things I wanted to say which were critical, it was going to be very difficult to do so. As it happened, I found the more work I did on these things, the more at a certain level I grew to respect these people. I, you know, I didn't necessarily agree with them, but I really felt, you know, these are mention. I know you're not allowed to call anybody a man anymore, but you know what I mean. I mean, I really felt these were men of both sexes, if you know what I mean. And I must say, all of the people I found myself dealing with, I really grew a great deal of respect for them, even at times when I felt that they were absolutely stark-raving bonkers. Now, I'm not sure that, well, I don't know how to say that anybody was actually stark-raving bonkers, but you're right. I mean, the people I interviewed were obviously the two main principals, Jim Lovelock and Lynn Margulis, because they were the people who pushed the Gaia hypothesis in the first place. And it made a lot of sense to go and interview a couple of Jim's students, a couple of people in England that he'd worked with. So I did this. And then I needed to talk to people who were, as it were, on the other side. And one of the, as you already mentioned, one of the people, as it were, in the general public who had made one of the biggest sort of vocal and internet commitments to Gaia was this man. He started life as Tim Zell, but he's now morphed into Oberon Zell Ravenheart, who is a, you know, a full-fledged wizard come pagan come whatever you like. And guess where he lives? No, it's not British Columbia. It's second best. It's California.
Ah.
And and so I went out to interview him and his wife, Morning Glory. Actually, Morning Glory is not well named because she has trouble getting up in the morning. She's a bit like my daughter who majored in afternoon studies. But anyhow, I went, and they, of course, they're my age. Well, they're not just about my age now. You know, they're late 60s, probably even early 70s. And, you know, they're like a couple of little old retired Unitarians, actually. I mean, what I realized was that although these people are pagans, although these people have some really nutty ideas about drawing down the moon and that sort of thing, I realize that these are just deeply religious people, and at a certain level, they're no different from the Archbishop of Canterbury, who I think also believes some very strange things about people rising from the dead and that sort of thing. So, you know, that's what I mean by respect. I don't agree with them, but at a certain level, I respected these people. And after all, when it came down to it, they're concerned about Mother Earth. They're concerned about the, you know, the place where we live. And hell, Give me somebody who's a pagan who cares about the earth that we live on against somebody who wants to drop, you know, bombs on little yellow men any day of the week. So, you know, as I say, I don't necessarily agree with these people, but I really did like them.
Right. And that empathy, that empathetic approach really does come out in the text of the book. And that's another thing that I think is so striking about the narrative. And it's one of the things that I think is going to make this a very good book to teach with as well. That there's a way that, while not losing sight of the narrative of the, you know, the really important distinctions on some level, and this is one of the themes that we'll talk about and one of the themes that runs through the book, the distinctions between the kinds of how to talk to and talk about the kinds of communities that constitute both professional scientists and then publics of various sorts, right? While not losing sight of those important differences, the book does really place them at the same level in terms of sympathetic characters. And that's, I think, a really hard thing to do, especially for someone who works in the history of philosophy of science. And it's one of the things that I think translates really well, and it'll translate really well to not just readers, but also to students in a classroom. So that was a really fun part of the book for me as well. So as we move into the chapters of the book, you've already talked a little bit about the two main characters, James Lovelock and Lynn Margulis. So the opening of the book sets out the moment in which Lovelock was actually inspired to come up with what ultimately winds up constituting at least this early part of the Gaia hypothesis. So you describe him while he was in California working for NASA, doing research on the atmospheric composition of Mars, being really struck by an image. And this is an image of the Earth as a living organism able to regulate its temperature and chemistry. So you've talked a little bit about him and his approach. One of the things that's really striking in this early part of the book, though, and this comes up again later, is that one of the sort of motivating factors or contributions to the way he winds up thinking about not just Gaia, but also his approach to the issues, the topic, is a friendship with someone who may strike readers and listeners as a surprising person in this story. And this is the author of Lord of the Flies, William Golding. So can you talk a little bit about Lovelock? What do we need to know about him to understand what's happening in this early part of the book? And where does his friendship with Golding come into the story?
Right. Well, let me just simply say that one of the things, and I mean, I'd like to think there are many themes which are going through this book, but one of the things that is very important to me in this book is the 1960s and the contradiction of different things going on there. It's the time of the Flower Children, time of the Beatles, it's the time of liberation through the pill and all of these sorts of things. It is the time when everybody was reading Lord of the Rings, not Lord of the Flies, rather, and this sort of thing. At the same time, It's the decade when you get these three horrendous assassinations, the two Kennedys and Martin Luther King. It's the time when Lyndon Johnson gets even more embroiled in Vietnam. And then, of course, Richard Nixon is elected president. And one of the things I'm trying to do in the book actually is play with this almost Hegelian contradiction of super science on the one hand. And Lovelock was very much into that. I mean, he was working for the space agency, for goodness sake. And yet, on the other hand, this whole business of the, you know, the Flower Children and that sort of thing. And as I say, Lord of the Flies. And when Lovelock goes back to England, who's the one person that he's really close to is William Golding, the novelist. And let's not spoil the surprise, because boy, did I ever find some unbelievable things before I finished this book. And let's leave that, you know, as I say, and let's use the Dickens, make them laugh, make them cry, make them wait, because it turned out, I'd written all about Golding at the beginning and how Golding, but I hadn't realized until late on in writing this damn book just exactly how explosive this was going to be. And I am very proud of all of this. Anyhow, so do understand then that what I'm starting with then is this, as I say, almost Hegelian contradiction of here's Lovelock, who's a man who's working for the space agency and yet comes up with this idea, which, you know, his fellow scientists think is flaky. And yet the Flower Children love. He brings in Lynn Margulis, who is, you know, I mean, admittedly, she'd been at Berkeley, but when she was at Berkeley, she was raising two small kids because Carl Sagan wasn't helping very much at the time. And so here's a woman who's working in, you know, in molecular biology, working at the level of the cell, and yet suddenly they come up with this idea, which is, you know, so 1960s in its way. And so at least part of what I'm trying to deal with is this, as I say, is the 1960s and the recognition that the 1960s themselves were such a conflicted decade of two sides not always getting on. And of course, this is, you know, a vital, as what should we say, an under theme of the book all the way.
So we've talked a little bit about Lynn Margulis, and listeners or readers may be most familiar with her as the founder of what's known as endosymbiotic theory. So we think of Lynn Margulis, we think of endosymbiosis, at least for people who aren't experts in this field and in this history. Now they meet, things start ramping up, or they start collaborating rather, and we get to an explanation of, and their initial at least articulation of what the Gaia hypothesis is. And one of the really interesting things at this part of the story is you're showing early in the book that the way certainly Lovelock is defining and articulating what the Gaia hypothesis is really changes somewhat or differs somewhat depending on the kind of audience he's aiming for. And so this is a way to start thinking about a more general claim, and I think a way for readers to use this example to think more broadly about, more generally, the impact of and the importance of modes of communication in the sciences. And this seems to be a point at which that really plays a role. So could you talk a little bit about, in the case of Lovelock and Margulis, how did the nature, if at all, of what they were claiming about Gaia change early on in this process, depending on the audience they were aiming for? How much of an impact did this have in this early history?
Well, I think that, I mean, there's two questions there. One is, how did they change as they moved, particularly Lovelock, as he moved from trying to talk to his fellow scientists to trying to talk to the general public? And we see this in the 1970s, as Lovelock basically, you know, for a while anyhow, more or less gives up on his fellow scientists and starts writing at a popular level. But the other thing, and I think that this was something which, again, took me, I didn't get it immediately, it took some time for it to get through my skull, was the realization that Lovelock is not a biologist. I mean, he spent an awful lot of time in art during the Second World War and afterwards dealing with things like the common flu and that influenza and that sort of thing. But he's not a biologist. He's a chemist. And so, of course, when he's approaching problems, he's got his, what should we say, paradigms, if you like. And if when Richard Dawkins or John Maynard Smith approach a problem, they've got theirs. For Dawkins and John Maynard Smith, natural selection is all important. And if you're talking about organisms, you can't talk about organisms except in terms of natural selection. For Jim Lovelock, when he's talking about things, he's talking about things getting into balance and that sort of thing, homeostasis. So he's defining organisms in terms of homeostasis. They're defining organisms in terms of natural selection. Jim's saying the Earth is in homeostasis. The biologists are saying natural selection didn't produce the Earth. So Jim's saying, yes, it is an organism. They're saying, no, it isn't. And at least a part of it is talking past each other. But not just that, because and this is really, really interesting. You know, when you're doing a book, first of all, you do all the copy editing, and then you get the proofs. And just before I was about to send off the material, I think actually it was the actual proofs. I was just about to send them off. And if you're like me, the night before you send them off, you start to panic and say, oh crikey, have I got everything wrong? Where is that crucial paper I started with? Let me reread it and make sure, you know, I didn't miss negatives in front of all the main verbs or something. So I did this the night before I was sending this stuff off, and I got it all right. I got it all right. And then I looked at their picture and I said, oh my God, this picture that they got in this journal was the crappiest picture I have ever seen. It was so small and so squashed. I mean, I would hold it up to the light before I could actually read, you know, the legend. And I said, oh, my God, they've got this picture of homeostasis right there. I missed it. In fact, I so far missed it. I went to Jim's book, which he published with Oxford, where he had a completely different diagram. And I spent a hell of a lot of time and a pile of money, too, on getting permission to reproduce that. And the night before I sent it off, I said, I don't need this. I want the original one. I went, no kidding, at 5 a.m, I got up to phone Holland, who'd got the, you know, by 8 o'clock, I'd got permission to use it. By 9 o'clock, I had my illustrator busy redrawing it. And at 10 o'clock, we were off to FedEx with a new picture, which showed that, you know, Jim may have got the story wrong. But by God, he found something which, you know, scientists should take very seriously. The Earth, the sun is heating up. The Earth was not heating up. What the hell is going on here? Now, you know, Jim may have been wrong about it being an organism. I mean, we can argue that one. But the biologists should have, you know, had at least, what shall I say, the modesty, the gumption, the whatever, to pull back and say, you know, he's absolutely wrong about his explanation. But, you know, the guy's got something we need to explain. Now, you know, it isn't just as easy as we think. But, of course, by that time, and I think there were reasons for this, which, again, make them cry, make them laugh, make them laugh, make them cry, make them wait. We'll get to that. But, I mean, the thing is, they were so wrapped up in what they were doing, they missed this. And I think, you know, now I can show that, that Jim had got a point. I mean, I don't think, I don't think that means the Earth is an organism, but he'd sure got something worth explaining. Why did the Earth stay balanced with respect to temperature when the sun was heating up? What you can extrapolate is that the Earth should have gotten a hell of a lot colder, you know, 3 billion years ago, and it should be have been heating up ever since until now, and it is getting hotter, of course. But it didn't do that. It stayed more or less constant. And I think Jim and Lynn had a point there, and people should have spotted that.
Great. Now, as we move into the book, and this is actually also, I'm glad you... It's really interesting to hear about this moment in your own thinking being stimulated by looking at an image, because again, this is another point at which there's so much happening in the book that speaks to more general issues of interest to people who may not imagine themselves fundamentally interested in the history of the Gaia hypothesis or evolution, but who are interested more generally in this as a way to model how to think about images as narrative, and these sort of very, very important fundamental questions that the book is dealing with implicitly or explicitly at the same time that we're looking at this really fascinating narrative of this particular scientific hypothesis. Now, as we move into further into the book, you set out the very different kinds of reactions had, and you've talked a little bit about this already, so I won't ask you too much about it, by biologists on the one hand, and you've mentioned Richard Dawkins a little bit. I also have to give a shout out because another figure that comes up in that part of the book is Stephen Jay Gould, and Steve was my undergraduate thesis advisor. So that was
that was you went
fun.
To Harvard, didn't
I
you?
Did.
You didn't go to Simon
guilty.
Fraser, did you?
No.
We are. Aha. I wondered about that element of arrogance. you didn't sound very Canadian to me, you know.
Oh, I'm very American. But so there's a lot of really interesting vignettes in that part of the book, too, that look at specific examples of the kinds of rather not just skeptical, but rather attacking kind of reactions from biologists. On the other hand, the public reaction is one of enthusiasm. And so what the rest of the book does after setting this up is really looking at the question and laying out an argument for exploring why the scientific community was so indifferent and then really hostile to this idea that Lovelock and Margulis has. And it turns out that the way to understand that question is to look back at the past, is to look back at the history of, and really the foundation of what had to happen in order to lead up to the kinds of circumstances, social, cultural, political, psychological, you name it, in which scientists found themselves when they were responding, and different communities of scientists in different ways responding to the work. So you take us through, in chapter 3, a really helpful kind of deep history of ideas of the earth as souled and ideas of world's soul thinking from Plato's Timaeus all the way through the scientific revolution and the importance of a machine metaphor, and then to German idealism with Schelling and this idea of the self-organization of nature. And what we see in this early part of the book is the emergence of kinds of themes that are going to continue to play out in different ways and not at all in a straightforwardly progressive narrative, and you're very clear about that, but that the seeds are laying here that are going to get dispersed and flower in interesting ways throughout the rest of the book. So one of the most important seeds here that we need to understand what happens is what you call mechanism, the idea of mechanism. So in chapter 4, you're showing how in the debate over Gaia, people are actually coming to the table with really different world concepts and philosophies of nature. And in the geological sciences and the biological sciences, one of the most important elements of thinking about nature was this idea of mechanism. And so could you talk a little bit about this part of the story? What do you mean by mechanism, and how is this play a really important part in this part, in this historical context that we need to understand what happens in reaction to Lovelock and Margulis's ideas?
Okay. By the way, going back to your teacher, Steve Gould, I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, he obviously, knew about everything, and he knew about Gaia. It was sort of interesting. It really wasn't his fight in a way that I think it was Dawkins's fight. Mm-hmm. But it's very interesting that he was very much like Dawkins, sort of giving it, he basically gave it the back of his hand and sort of blew it off. And as I say, in the book, I think it's very interesting that he did this, because Steve was incredibly sensitive to metaphor and this sort of thing, which, of course, the Gaia hypothesis is. And so I thought it was particularly interesting. So it's almost, what should we say, not the main theme of the book, but a little bit at the end. Why was Steve giving it the back of his hand, too? Anyhow, so to pick up the story, I mean, basically what I say is, first of all, the Gaia hypothesis did not start with Jim Lovelock in 1965. I mean, the idea goes back to Plato, or even before Plato, and it's got a venerable history. And I say one of the interesting things is that you get the scientific revolution in the 16th and 17th centuries, when you change from the idea of the world as an organism to the world as a machine. And yet, nevertheless, there's always this sort of minority position which continues to think in organic terms and thinks that the Earth is an organism. And you mentioned Schelling, and I think it's particularly interesting. And again, this is one of the great things about doing research, is you do learn things. I mean, I knew who Schelling was, but I'd never bothered. I mean, Schelling wasn't my sort of philosopher. I'd never read him at all. And yet here he becomes suddenly incredibly important in my story. Well, one of the absolute key figures. And so I end, as it were, the first part of the history, you're right, by saying, well, we lead up to Schelling, who is a full-blown believer in the Earth as an organism. And then what I'm trying to do then is obviously with an eye to the present. I mean, I don't want to say the present is right and everything works up to the present, but what I'm trying to do is use history to understand the present. Mm-hmm. And I say, well, what are, as it were, the main, what should we call them, the methodological paradigms that we're going to be working with today? Well, obviously, one is the scientific revolution's paradigm of mechanism, the Earth as a machine. One of the things I'm interested in then is, well, how does mechanism, or how did mechanists deal with the whole question of the Earth and that sort of thing? So I look at people, as I say, like Hutton in 18th century Scotland, and then I look at Lyell, I look down to plate tectonics and show how plate tectonics is very much a mechanistic view of the world. The world is just basically it's a new common engine with, the engine that they invented in the 18th century for pumping water, which goes round and round and round. And so I try to show how mechanistic thinking dominates in geology. And then I move on to Darwin and the Darwinian revolution. And again, I want to say that Darwin is very much a mechanist in this sort of way, and that natural selection is this very much this sort of vision of biology, which fits in with geology. So this is one vision that I got and that as I come up to the present. But I want to say it's not the only one. And one of the things that, again, I'm really rather proud of is to say that I think that in respectable science, particularly at your alma mater at Harvard, and then going up at the beginning of the 20th century, then going over to Chicago a little later, the University of Chicago, that you get this what I call holistic or organismic thinking, which is much more geared to a less of a reductionistic, let's blast it all to pieces and start with the molecules, and much more, let's look at holistically. And in fact, I do take this back to Schelling, because Schelling was tremendously influential on the American transcendentalists, people like Emerson. And of course, Emerson, where was Emerson hanging out? He was hanging out in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Who was he talking to? People like Louis Agassiz, who'd just come from Switzerland to be professor of biology at Cambridge, and this sort of thing. So I very much trace Schelling's influence up through the transcendentalists and on to Harvard and to Chicago. And in fact, to anticipate what I'm going to say, is I want to argue that ultimately I see Jim Lovelock as very much in a mechanistic framework. And so then I've got to explain, why is he into Gaia? Whereas I see Lynn Margulis, who was an undergraduate at Chicago in the 1950s in their Great Books program. I see Lynn as, for Lynn, Gaia, in some sense, is mother's milk, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. She grew up with this kind of overall organicist view. So I don't see Lynn as being a problem in any sense at all. What's interesting is I think that this organicist view characterizes your teacher, Steve Gould, for all he may have been given at the back of his hand. I think that Steve, in many respects, was very empathetic to a holistic view of nature. And Emerson said to Thoreau, what are you doing? Well, Henry, why are you in prison? And Thoreau said, Waldo, why aren't you in prison? And I want to say, Steve, why weren't you in on Gaia? I mean, I know why he wasn't. But, I mean, at a certain level, he ought to have been, I think, a hell of a lot more empathetic than he was. I mean, as I say, he's a metaphor man. He's a holist. He ought to have been there. So these are two other things. I don't want to run out of time because we have to get to Oberon's Ravenheart.
I'm bringing us right there, right as soon as you're done.
Okay, right.
So let's move there then. Let's get to him. So this is for listeners who are, just to let them know where we are in the book. So we've just looked at, in the book, a chapter on mechanism, a chapter on organicism, and then there's this chapter on what you call hylozoism. This chapter focuses on the ideas of those who accepted that the Earth was living, was some sort of living being or living creature, was alive in some way. And it turns to look at popular science, pseudoscience, and religion, which are interestingly related to each other in this part of the book, even while they're distinct kinds of things. And so that relationship itself is really interesting. Now, here's where we get to the emerging importance in the story of people like Rudolf Steiner and his idea of anthroposophy. We get to Rachel Carson and her work in Silent Spring. You talk about Aldo Leopold and ecological philosophers. So there's a lot of really interesting kinds of movements and people associated with those movements in this part of the book. One of those people, so let's just get right to him, and one of the movements that you talk about is this Oberon Zell Ravenheart that we talked about at the very beginning, and his involvement with what you call paganism. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about him, and especially because paganism, or the idea of a pagan planet, constitutes the subtitle of the book itself. So could you talk a little bit about him and his idea of paganism in the context of what's happening in this chapter, and also in the context of what's happening at this part of the story?
Yes. Well, now the thing is, in this chapter, I'm basically trying to look at the general public. And ultimately, I want to know why it was that the general public was so keen on Gaia. And I don't think that problem is so difficult. I mean, basically, I want to say American transcendentalism not only went into the science at Harvard, but it went into the general public, but more so through Thoreau, I think, than Emerson. As I say, American kids. My kids at high school read, you know, Thoreau. I mean, this is part of the mother's milk for Americans. And of course, Thoreau is, you know, deeply committed to the idea of organicism, of the earth as an organism, that we owe, you know, that we shouldn't just destroy it for our own ends and this sort of thing. And I'm able to trace this through people like John Muir, the founder of the Sierra Club, and then in the 20th century, Aldo Leopold, that this whole organicist or hylozoist, the idea of the earth as an organism, is right there, and then through the deep ecologists and the ecofeminists, and on, as I say, to this group I just love, the pagans. Very interesting, you know. In a way, the Gaia hypothesis can be very tricky for regular Christians, particularly for evangelicals, because they want to say the only value comes from God, and that the earth only has value in as much as it is related to and seen a creation of God. Whereas, of course, the Gaia hypothesis and the Gaia thinking wants to say, no, the earth has value in itself, and we don't need to bother. I mean, it's not a question we don't need to bother with God, but God, you know, God is not part of this. It's that's what I mean by a pagan planet. And what I want to pick up on here is, as I think the pagans are the best manifestation of this, of people who say, no, we don't want to get into Judeo-Christian gods or even the Eastern gods, because a lot of them, you know, take up Eastern stuff of one sort or another. But we don't want to get into that. We want to talk about the earth itself as Mother Earth, that which we should worship, that which we should care. And of course, this is paganism. And this chap, as I say, started life as Tim Zell, but has morphed into Oberon Zell Ravenheart. I liken him to St. Paul, because I say, you know, if you're going to found a religion, you've not only got to have the theology, but you've got to have the organizing abilities. And by God, he had the organizing abilities. The first thing he did was get the IRS to declare it a religion, so he got taxing exempt status. I mean, he really is quite a lad in that respect. And so, and he really did get the Gaia idea separately. But of course, then when he started reading Lovelock, you know, he got into correspondence and that sort of thing. And of course, today, you know, he's a very enthusiastic supporter. So basically, I want to argue that the whole idea the earth as an organism is in respects very much an American tradition. It's not a universal one because, as I say, a lot of evangelicals feel very uncomfortable with it. But, you know, there's an awful lot of people out there, not just young people. I'll bet you 90% of people who are in the Sierra Club, you know, at some gut feeling, some gut sense, think that the earth is our mother and it really is living in some sort of way. And I mean, as I say, I'm not sure I agree with this, but I feel very empathetic to it. Now, let me lay on top of this, as it were, my second theme. As I grew up in England, my folks were Quakers, then my mother died, my father married a German woman whose family are deeply into this, what shall I call him, this German clairvoyant or whatever he is, Rudolf Steiner. He's the founder of the Waldorf schools, which are incredibly popular all over North America. And Steiner, who, you know, believed a lot of very strange things like that there are two Jesuses and that sort of thing. But he was very deeply committed to the idea of the earth as an organism. And he started a kind of organic gardening in the 1920s known as a biodynamic gardening. Well, I discovered that Rachel Carson's had a network of people in the 1950s, late 1950s, a network of people feeding her information clippings and that sort of thing. And probably the key person was a woman called Marjorie Spock, who in fact was the younger sister of Benjamin Spock, the pediatrician. And Marjorie Spock was feeding Rachel Carson a huge amount of stuff. Marjorie Spock was an absolutely flat-out Steiner fanatic. They call themselves anthroposophists, and she'd been an anthroposophist since the 20s and gone to Germany or Switzerland, Dornach, to study with Steiner. And so she was doing biodynamic gardening. And one of the leaders, or the leader in America, of the biodynamic thing, I think he must have been German, Ehrenfeld Pfeiffer, had in fact in 1958, at the beginning of 1958, published this 30-page pamphlet absolutely hammering DDT and going on about the dangers it was. they gave it to Rachel Carson. She used it right the way through Silent Spring. Mentioned it once in the preface that she... Now, we know why, because she was going to be hammered by the government and by the chemical companies and that sort of thing. So she very deliberately didn't mention any of this. But it's all there that Rudolf Steiner had a huge impact on the American environmentalist movement. So this was my first discovery. I got the second one coming up with William Golding, and I'm sure you're going to ask me about that.
Well, we can let readers or let potential readers wait for that if you want to keep that a secret. We can let them let them stew and buy the book and see what happened to William Golding.
Well, that's the sad truth of that, you know.
Well, so as we move into this concluding few chapters of the book, we move from these really interesting deep treatments of ways of thinking about the world that kind of lay the foundation for what's going to come, and we move back to the context of Lovelock and Margulis and people who they're directly engaging with in chapters that are devoted to revisiting this idea of Gaia and seeing what happens later on at the end of the story. So one of the things that comes up in this part of this last part of the story that's really important and really interesting, and you mentioned it early on as well, is the nature of Lovelock's approach and training in a fascination with machines, with machine building, with tinkering, with model making. And you mentioned that this is actually an important part of the story and an important part of his way of not just thinking about the Gaia hypothesis, but also devising kinds of evidence to try to buttress his argument. And so you talk about this really fascinating Daisy World computer model and among other things. Can you talk a little bit about, as we now come back to some of the protagonists of the story, let's go back to Lovelock. Why is this background in and tendency to think in terms of tinkering and models and machine building so important to understanding what eventually happens with him? And how do his ideas change by the end of the story?
What's interesting about Lovelock is that by the he comes up with this idea of Gaia on his own, I think, in the mid-60s. Then he goes back to England. He's been working in California. He goes back to England, and he wants isolation because he wants to be able to work on his models and these sorts of things. I mean, this is the way the man makes his money, and he doesn't want, you know, to be distracted all the time. So he goes and lives in this small village in Wiltshire, I think, and who's the other main inhabitant, as it were, well-known inhabitant of this village, but none other than William Golding, the novelist, who's also gone to the village so that he can get away from the distractions and write his novels. Well, so the only people whom they meet are each other, you know, three or four times a week down in the pub. And, you know, Lovelock's open about this. They would spend, you know, three or four times a week, they would be gossiping and, you know, having a few beers in the pub, as one does in England. I mean, and it's clear that Lovelock is very influenced by Golding. Now, Golding is fascinating because we all know, if you read any of Golding's novels, you know the extent to which the spiritual side of things is right there. I mean, the whole thing about Lord of the Flies is all about original sin. These boys go to this island and, you know, things go downhill from there. It's all about the Augustinian notion of original sin. Golding, as a young man, had been an incredible enthusiast for Rudolf Steiner, of all people. And although he gave up the sort of, you know, the nuttier aspects, remained sympathetic to the end of his life. And so here comes Jim Lovelock, all about Gaia. He's talking to one of the few people in England who's, as it were, what should we say, pre-adapted to this idea. And so it's clear that Jim's getting an awful lot from Lovelock. And, of course, Lovelock's getting it back. And, in fact, in Lovelock's Nobel Prize-winning lecture in Sweden, he mentions Gaia. Now, I asked Jim about this. I asked Lovelock. And, of course, as you might expect, he says, no. Well, you know, tell that to the Marines. Apart from anything else, the Lovelocks had a handicapped child. And for 8 years, they had this handicapped child in a Steiner school that they thought very highly of. So, you know, Jim knew all about that. Jim knew all about the Steiner philosophy and these things. As I say, I don't think he bought into any of the, you know, the highfalutin stuff about angels and Jesuses and that sort of thing. But the whole notion of a holistic world, which is fundamental to anthroposophy, was right there. So he was, you know, he was drenched in it, you know, all these years. So why am I not surprised that Jim Lovelock, you know, is a Gaia enthusiast, you know, because of his background?
Right. So as we come to the kind of the closing of the story, or as we approach the closing of the story, that's what happens with Lovelock. But there's also Margulis. And one of the really interesting things that happens in this last part of the book is that you're setting out an understanding of Lovelock in terms of his kind of not affiliation with, but his sympathy toward and resonance with a kind of mechanistic approach. In contrast, Margulis emerges as more aligned with the organicists, right, and the holists. And we talked about the distinction a little bit earlier on. So what happens with Margulis? How does her approach change? And what do I need to understand about her at this last
part? Well, again, as I say, this is an interesting question, because what's so fascinating is that Lovelock and Margulis worked together really quite intimately for 4 or 5 years, and then basically they go their different ways, and they always remain friends, they always remain incredibly supportive, but by and large Gaia is no longer Lynn's baby, as it were, and she even says, you know, I'm not even sure if the metaphor of the world as an organism is a good idea. You know, now, for a moment, I wondered whether, you know, they'd had a little bit of hanky-panky and, you know, split. Well, you see, the thing is, Lovelock keeps going on about how dissatisfying his first marriage was, but he assures us in his autobiography, and Lynn told me, I asked her about this, she said, no, there was nothing sexual between us. The thing is, as Jim said this, she's a biologist. He's an organic chemist. He wants to do models. He wants to do mathematics. That isn't what Lynn wanted to do. And as Jim said, you know, I can't work, you know, collaboratively with somebody who's not going to do these sorts of things. And so, of course, what Jim does is find his own students, and these are the people I interviewed, who are prepared to do the kind of work that he does. Lynn, meanwhile, is off on her own thing, doing, you know, symbiosis and all of these sorts of things. And in fact, by the time she died, she was very much out of favor in the scientific community, because she'd got all of these symbiotic ideas that everybody thought was total nonsense, but never stopped her for a moment. I mean, she was, you know, she was a wonderful person like that. I mean, you know, she may be dead wrong, but by God, you know, Lynn, you know, had she got the guts of her convictions, and that's what I mean by empathy. You know, I didn't agree with her at all, but oh God, I loved her.
That's great. Thank you so much. And I think just for listeners who are with us, in the course of your discussion of her work in this last part of the book, you go into it, and I won't ask you to talk too much about this, but you go into her interaction with, or her engagement with, another thread that runs through the book, which is the importance of thinking about different levels of selection, which is something that's really important, really throughout the story. You also talk about her thinking that Gaia was in conflict with Darwinism, and ultimately we see her, as you mentioned, at the end of the story, in a quite different place from where she began. So it's a
right. Yeah, well, that's interesting, because as I say, Jim, I think, I don't think Jim was ever a biologist, but when these things about the way natural selection works were explained to Jim, he soaked it right up and came right back and said, let me see if I can make my ideas work this way. As far as Lynn was concerned, you know, she just gave them the finger and said, you know, you know, she said, you know, if neo-Darwinism thinks that, then so much the worse for neo-Darwinism. I mean, so, you know, one of the fascinating things in the story is the fact that these are, in many respects, two very different people with very different philosophies in many ways. I mean, of course, Steve would never, you know, he could never have bought the ideas of the later Lynn. No more could anybody else. But at a certain level, I think Steve Gould's philosophy was much closer to that of Lynn Margulis than it ever would have been to Jim Lovelock.
Well, thank you so much, Michael. And before we come to... Oh, sorry.
We've got one final thing we've got to say, Carla.
Oh, well, we'll say a few things, finally, but you can jump in now. I was going
right,
to keep
well,
you for at least
course,
a few
minutes. The punchline is, then I've explained, I think, why it was that the general public liked Guy. As I say, I think this is an American tradition, which goes back to the Transcendentalists. But why did the scientific community hate Guy so much?
Well, I want to... You're anticipating what my next question was.
Okay, you ask it.
So
you ask it, and I'll answer it. How's
so,
that?
So, Michael, so I've got this very surprising question for you.
Yeah.
Why did the professional scientific community turn so violently against the Gaia idea?
God, you Harvard people are all so bloody predictable, aren't you? You know, it's from Harvard, you can say exactly what you're going to say next. Is I'm number one and you're not. And then, okay, and listen. You can tell I've got one or two colleagues down here who went to a university not too far from, you know, downtown Boston. And I don't mean MIT. I mean, why was the scientific community so against it? And the answer I want to argue is the following, is I want to say that scientists turn nasty when they're feeling threatened, when they're insecure. And this is when people start talking pseudoscience. My favorite example actually is Florida State. When I came just over 10 years ago, there was big talk about founding a medical school here. Well, a lot of people, including me, thought it was a lousy idea because medical schools, apart from anything else, you know, absorb all the funds on campus. And anyhow, they went ahead and founded one, and we were right. They did absorb all the funds on campus. But at the same time, obviously, the medical school was very insecure because here they were, a new school, not very much loved. And then one of the influential state legislators, who was a chiropractor, got, I don't know, $25 million or something from the legislature to found a sort of a school of chiropractic within our medical school, you know, a sort of faculty of chiropractic. Our doctors, our medics went absolutely, and the only word I can use is apeshit, they just went bananas at this idea. They were terrified. A pseudoscience, crank science, nonsense. And we know why. It wasn't that they disliked chiropractors. I mean, you know, there are lots of chiropractors in Tallahassee, and the medics get on perfectly well with them. But if they were seen to embrace a pseudoscience like that, everybody would look down on it. I mean, I laugh. I say, if Harvard wanted to start a department of chiropractic, I'll bet they could get away with it. But Florida State just can't. And so what I want to say is that terms like pseudoscience tend to get flung around when scientists, it's not just that it is a pseudoscience, but it's when scientists are themselves insecure. Well, by the 70s, and you mentioned groups, you know, with the levels of selection debate, the 70s, evolutionary biologists were tearing themselves apart. Your teacher, Stephen Jay Gould, with his theory of punctuated equilibrium, was upsetting conventional paleontologists, and so they were shouting at each other. The sociobiologists were yelling at each other. You know, there was Ed Wilson on the one hand saying, both at Harvard, saying, you know, I think that humans are, you know, controlled by their genes, and Dick Lewontin, same department, saying, no, they're not. Then you've got the taxonomists, the cladists fighting. I mean, everybody was fighting. And so they were really pretty, you know, they weren't happy campers. And so when Jim Lovelock turns up and says, you know, naively, oh, the Earth's an organism and I can show it. And, they, you know, in a way, I won't say it was with relief, but in a way they turned on him, you know, because they themselves were so insecure, and you know they savaged him. And the fascinating thing is, by the late 1990s, when evolutionary biology had calmed right down and everybody was feeling a lot happier with each other, and you know even people were even speaking to Steve Gould and that sort of thing, they admitted, and there's a lovely quote I've got by John Maynard Smith, an eminent evolutionist, who says to Lovelock, he says, you know, Jim, the trouble is, we were fighting so much about levels of selection and all of these sorts of things, and then you came along, and you know, he said, Jim, it was bad timing. It was bad timing. And Lovelock says, you know, I think it probably was. I think it probably was. And so what I want to say is, you know, I think I can explain it, but it in a way, it, God forbid that I'm giving a sociological explanation. I'm a philosopher. You know, we look down on historians, but what, how we regard sociologists is, you know. But anyhow, the thing is, I'm giving a sociological or psychological sociological explanation and saying, I think a lot of this hostility, you know, came from personal insecurity. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a wonderfully satisfying end to anything to say, Richard Dawkins, you know, the reason why he's so unpleasant is because he's insecure. But, you know, that's the kind of conclusion I like to have.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for spending the time to talk with us today. This has been great. This not only was it great fun talking with you, but the book itself is just a wonderful book. And it's there's so much in the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about. It's full of stories.
Well, really, buy the book. Buy the book.
Exactly.
So, I know. If you're in America, it's only $19 on Amazon, and that's postage paid.
Well, before we sign off, is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
Not really. I mean, gosh, we've talked about it for an hour or more. I mean, one of the nice things, it's not that long a book. And I hate footnotes, so there's no footnotes, folks. There's lots of references, but there's no footnotes. And there are a couple of... And I think I must be the first philosopher ever to use the word motherfucker in the introduction to a book. And I'm very proud of that.
Hopefully not the last. So, Michael, my final question to you before I let you go. Now that the book is out, you've already talked about some other really exciting projects that you've been working on that have come out already very recently. What's next for you? What project or projects are inspiring you right now?
Well, what I really like to do is not a follow-up, as it were, not a sequel, but I really want to look at global warming. Now, of course, everybody looks at global warming, but I want to look at some of the, what I call the apocalyptic themes in global warming, because it seems to me that both sides are into, you know, very American Armageddon doomsday sort of themes, you know, millennial themes. And I want to link this to a lot of American thought. You know, oh my God, we've sinned. We must all move to North Dakota. Oh no, God, let's think of something evil. We must all move to Saskatchewan and live in yurts and eat nothing but raw vegetables. Oh my God, we've sinned. If we do this, maybe God will forgive us, you know. And I've got a feeling that there's another wonderful story to be mined there. So ask me again in 2 or 3 years' time, and we'll see where I'm at then.
I will do. I'll look forward to talking with you about that book as well. So good luck, and thank you so much for talking with me today about the book, and congratulations.
My pleasure, Carla.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.